Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about the third of the three mottos, the third part of Dado Rinpoche's motto, Radiate Love. Actually, Bhante gave a talk on this motto called, I think, The Message of Dado Rinpoche, which is worth looking at. He looks at these three aspects. And what Bhante says about that, when he talks about radiate love, I mean, of course, Bhante used the dictionary to explore what these terms mean. I will come back to that later. I will come back later to what he says about radiate. But what he says about love is, it means matter. So, or Maitri in Sanskrit. So the point is that with radiate love, what Dado Rinpoche is saying is radiate matter. So in a sense, I'm going to talk about matter this evening. And I want to talk about three main areas. So my talk will have three main points. I will talk about metta as we practice it, or as we can practice it. And the second main area, which is probably a bigger one even, is I'm trying to look at how metta, or altruism, or compassion, is regarded in Dado Rinpoche's context. Because he came from a particular tradition, from a particular way of thinking about the Dharma. So I try to explore what he probably meant by metta, or love. Of course, guesswork, obviously, but yeah, just draw on the tradition he's from, the sort of Tibetan Mahayana tradition. And then finally, I'm going to talk about how the slogan Radiate Love fits with the other two slogans, and how all three of them fit together. So these are the three main areas of my talk. So metta, in a sense, it's sort of a sort of nothing to say you don't know yet, because, I mean, I don't, in fact, like when I prepared the talk, I don't need to tell you why matter is important. I mean, you should know that by now. Yeah. But I want to draw out a few points. One thing about the importance of the metta bhavana and metta is just a quick quote from Bhante's talk, A System of Meditation. And it's basically saying is, the talk is from 1979. So as I come into contact with more and more order members, more and more mitras, more and more friends, I see more and more clearly and more definitely the importance of positive emotions in our lives, whether spiritual lives or worldly lives. I would say that the development of positive emotions, emotions of friendliness, joy, peace, faith, serenity, is absolutely crucial for our development as individuals. It's after all the emotions which keep us going. We are not kept going by abstract ideas. We are kept going by our emotions. And it is our positive emotions which keep us going on the spiritual path, which give us inspiration, enthusiasm, and so on. So positive emotions in the fullest sense are of particular importance within the order and within the movement in general. We should have strong feelings of metta towards our own self, to begin with, and others. Should have strong feelings of spiritual fellowship. And when I say strong feelings, I mean strong feelings. Not something tepid and lukewarm and half-hearted and faint-hearted, but really warm, even if you like a little hot, and strong, not feeble. Yeah, so this is of him saying, why is the metta bhavana important? Why is it an important practice? Yeah, we need, basically, we are driven by our emotions. In another paper, I think it's in the essay The Good Friend, from which he wrote in Kalimpong early 1950s, probably 54. It says, I think there is the famous quote that we have to find emotional equivalent of our intellectual understanding. I think it's in there. And he says friendship is that emotional equivalent of non-self. Quite interesting. Yes, he says, well, matter is important. In Living with Kindness, in the first chapter, he gives a very good overview of a matter. This of matter is of in three ways, or in three ways he describes matter. He says, it's an ardent goodwill. It's a care and concern directed to all beings. An unfailing sign of matter is that you're deeply concerned for the well-being, happiness, and prosperity of the object of your matter. So he says, it's a goodwill. You wish the other person well. The second point he makes, it's an ecstatic energy. So don't be too precious to refine it out of existence. He quotes the Pali Canon, metta burns and shines and blazes forth. So So it should be something strong. And the third thing he's saying is it's a rational emotion. Metta is the adequate response to other beings. So it is an emotion which is in harmony with reality. So I think it goes back to an idea that some emotions are rational, which means they're in harmony with reality, and some emotions are not rational. So fear of spiders is an irrational emotion, for example. Yeah. So he makes these 3 points. Metta is the adequate response to other beings. Actually, I've got a sense that metta is the obvious response to other beings. So if you see what we are and what other beings are, metta is the only logical response to any other being, any other sentient being. It'll probably clearer as I go on. There has to be that fellow feeling if we are to experience our humanity to the full. Yeah. So it's part of us being humans, having this fellow feeling with other people. So this is how Bhante describes metta or talks about metta in Living with Kindness. I just want to give a few thoughts now about our training in metta. Just a few ideas which you may find useful. So the first thing I want to make is metta has to start with real people, specific people. I mean, that's why our metta bhavana starts with self, friend, neutral person, enemy. It has to be directed towards real people, concrete people in our surroundings. In a way, loving humanity is very easy because we never meet it. We never contact all beings. All beings don't exist for us. It's a pure abstraction. It's incredibly easy to love all beings because they don't exist. It's just an idea. Yeah, we can't love all beings as an abstraction if we don't love particular people, particular beings around us. Yeah, so metta has to start with specific people. It has to be directed to the people around us. The other point, I think it's related to that, is for me, metta is based on awareness of other people. First of all, metta is a kind of awareness. In the Pali, in the Metta Sutta, a famous text about metta, it is actually called a mindfulness. Yeah? And the Pali word is sati, the word we use for mindfulness. So metta is a mindfulness, the mindfulness of other people. So metta is based on being aware of another person. In order to feel empathy for another person, to feel love or metta to another person, it's of obvious say really, we have to be aware of them as a living being rather than our idea of them. So we need to be aware of another person in order to feel metta towards them. I mean, a very practical way of doing the metta bhavana, which I find very helpful, is when the bell goes and the person pops up, so to speak, spend some time being aware of the person and your response before you do metta. I mean, it's a very practical way of doing that. I find it really helpful. It's really good just to sit with the person, look at your response, be aware of them before you start developing metta for them. Otherwise, you don't develop metta for them into some idea you may have. Yeah. Yeah, so it's based on awareness of other people. And actually, I might go further than that. It could even be that this is enough. What I sometimes find in the metta bhavana, just being aware of another person as a living being could already be enough to feel metta. Yeah, to feel some warmth. So it might even be enough. Yeah, so metta is based on awareness. Another point about the metta bhavana is keep the practice simple. Don't make it unnecessarily complicated. I think we can have the tendency of making our practices full of, so filling our practices with ideas and concepts and thoughts. And it can happen in the metta bhavana. Yeah? So sort of keep the practice simple. Yeah, you don't need to come up with complicated, well, actually I would advise you not to do it. Don't come up with complicated therapy plans for the people to develop metta for. That's not metta bhavana. Yeah, that's just sort of, you're just full of ideas basically. So keep the practice simple. Don't expect too much. Don't do too much. Just sort of stay with the person, develop friendliness. Do as little as necessary. I think it's true for all meditations. Yeah, do as little as necessary. Keep the practice simple. Don't overcomplicate the practice with any ideas of psychology or whatever. Yeah, just be aware of them as a human being. So keep the practice simple and uncluttered. The next point, actually, just going to change the order of the points. The next point I want to make is, speaking to myself here basically as well as to others, the beginning of the fifth stage is really important. You know, so if you bring all four people together and to develop metta for all four equally. I mean, I'm probably guilty of that as well as probably many of us. It's something I tend to go over very quickly. Yeah. But actually, I think it's a very important point. And whenever I actually make the effort of staying with that stage, I can get very concentrated. I don't know how the mechanics of it. I don't know how it functions, but it works. Yeah. So the beginning of that stage, we have all four people together, yourself, friend, enemy, neutral person, you develop metta for all four equally strong. So you go beyond likes and dislikes. It's quite an important part in the metta bhavana. Yeah. But I think I'm certainly guilty of sort of neglecting that part. And then also metta is expansive. Look for in the final stage especially, look for the quality of expansion. As Dado Rinpoche says, it's more radiate love. It's something expansive. And the expansion of metta is not some pushing metta through the universe. It's more a friendly mental state is naturally expansive. Yeah? It means you go with the natural tendency of your mind to expand, to include more and more people. A selfish mental state feels narrow. An unselfish mental state feels broad, feels expansive. So look for the quality of expansion. That's another point I wanted to make. It's pretty intriguing. Somewhere in the Pali, I couldn't find the quote because I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, and this is sort of this huge volume which I didn't have time to go through this afternoon over the last few days. There is a sutta where the Buddha talks about the different states that four different Brahmaviharas can lead into. They're all different. I must check that out. It's quite interesting. I think it's actually the only place I noticed in the Pali Canon where the Buddha describes the differences between the four Brahmaviharas. I don't think he ever describes the differences between them. But in this one, he describes them individually. And in this one, metta leads to a state called the beautiful. Yeah. That's quite interesting. And made me think of what's behind all that, what that means. And one thing I take from that, again, something I'd like to explore more in my own practice. For me, that hints at or points at the fact that there should be something enjoyable about metta. And it can happen. I think if you're very sort of in a certain way idealistic, metta, your feeling of metta towards other people, your altruism can be almost a bit, almost misanthropic. Yeah? There's poor people who suffer and I have to help them. Yeah? But what metta seems to be is actually, my impression is what's important is to enjoy people, basically. Yeah. I noticed that if you know that sort of sometimes you go into town and you've got this sort of Buddhist moralizing mind on all these people are consumers, they're unhappy and so on. But actually, if you drop that, most people are actually enjoyable and all right. Most normal people are actually quite good. Yeah. You go to a shop, the shop assistant enjoys their contact with you. Yeah. On a very normal human level. Yeah. So I think this sort of element of enjoyment and beauty in matter for me hints at sort of the ability to enjoy human beings. Because I think we're a brilliant species, absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. Really, seriously. Yeah. We're brilliant. We're not some horrible disease on the planet, not at all. But if you can't like humanity, I mean, you're one of them. So what are you going to do? So I think part of metta is enjoying people, the ability to just almost of harmless, innocent enjoyment of people without suspicion and cynicism, yeah, and moralizing. So it's a few qualities of metta I want to bring in just in terms of how to practice metta bhavana. I will come back to the radiating quality. Yeah, maybe one more word on that. And Bhatti quoted himself, is metta is described as shining, bright, radiating. So, yeah, look for that quality of brightness, lightness, light. Yeah, it burns. It's described as a fire, it burns. Yeah. I mean, in the Padikan, I think it's the Ittivutaka reading, quite a famous reading, is metta, which outshines all other qualities. This is quite, I mean, I'm sure you heard the reading, don't know by heart, obviously, but so it's described just as the moon outshines all stars, metta outshines all other qualities. And it burns, blazes, and shines. So there's something shining, burning, blazing about metta, something fiery. So it's a few ideas or hints at how we can practice metta. Now we talk about the next level. So of course it's a bit of guesswork now on my part, but I want to talk now about what Dado Rinpoche may have had in mind when he talked about love and metta. So Dado Rinpoche was obviously part of, well, his tradition is the Tibetan Mahayana tradition, or the Gelug tradition more exactly, which puts a lot of emphasis on the Bodhisattva idea. Yeah. I think we heard in the life story when Pama Sarg gave his talk on Dado Rinpoche that he visualized Tsongkhapa, the founder of his school. And Tsongkhapa is in one line with Atisha, the mind training tradition, Langri Tangpa, and Shantideva, yeah, the Bodhisattva. That's in a sense one tradition, one particular tradition, line of tradition. And then it goes back to Nagarjuna. But yeah, he's same tradition. Yeah, Tsongkhapa and Dado Rinpoche, it's the same tradition as Shantideva, who wrote the Bodhisattva. So that's his thinking, or that trained his thinking about metta and altruism. So I'm going to talk a bit now about the Bodhisattva ideal as it's described in these Mahayana texts, the Bodhisattva and some of the other texts. It's going to get interesting now. You could say the whole argument of Shantideva and this Mahayana tradition is there's absolutely no Buddhist life without altruism, without compassion, without love. It just does not exist. It's the Bodhisattva ideal is a non-self-centered Buddha. There's no self-centered Buddhist life. It's impossible. Yeah. I mean, Shantideva is very poetic, as we all know, but he's in the tradition of Nagarjuna. He's incredibly logical. It's basically, well, Buddhism says self-centeredness is the problem. I mean, that's basic Buddhism. Yeah, that's what the Buddha taught. Okay, so self-centeredness is the problem. And the language Shantideva uses is not only a problem, it's our biggest enemy. It's our worst enemy. Is our own mind and our self-centeredness. Nothing can harm us as much. So you need to kill it. You need to smash that enemy quite easy, quite simply. Yeah? Destroy it. And you do that by altruism. You defeat your self-centeredness by being altruistic. Yeah? So that's the argument in a way. And this is basically what underlines all the Mahayana teachings, all these teachings from the Tibetan Mahayana tradition. I mean, in a sense, what it's saying is our problem is too much self-concern. The problem is that we're too self-concerned. And maybe what this, I mean, complete guesswork, you know, why these traditions emerged, but it's very easy for Buddhists to become too self-obsessed because we practice mindfulness. Yeah. And it's very easy for Buddhists to become sort of almost narcissistic, yeah, and finding out the minutiae of our mind incredibly important and meaningful. Maybe the tradition emerged because of that. Because, okay, forget about all the details of what your body is doing. So, yeah, it's all right, but you need to know that to some extent. But really, it's about altruism. Yeah. Or everything we do, all other practices are not complete. I think it's a Tibetan tradition. No practice is complete without the motivation of altruism. Yeah, any practice you do, mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, of insight practices, reflecting on the lakshanas, whatever you do, is incomplete without an altruistic motivation. So you only do it to be of welfare, of benefit for other people, other beings. So Shantideva has two stages of that. And I think the first stage is a brilliant description of how to do the metta bhavana. It's great. The first stage is sameness of self and other. Yeah. So very logical again. Just to read a few verses from that. All equally experience suffering and happiness. I should look after them as I do myself. And then later, the very good ones, where is it? When happiness is liked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive after happiness only for myself? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not the other? I think it's of Metta Bhavana in two verses, basically. So this is the sameness of self and other. I'm going to quote, let's have a look. Therefore, in the same way that one desires to protect oneself from affliction, grief, and the like, so an attitude of protectiveness and of compassion should be practiced towards the world. And so it's of course, well, fundamentally, there's no difference between me and others, so it's completely illogical to think I'm more important than others. That's the sameness of self and others. Then comes the next stage, and this needs to be the basis. In a way, I think the way to look at it is we use our inborn selfishness to develop metta. We know what it's like to care for ourselves. We know what it's like. Yeah? We know what it's like to be a human being. Yeah, we know what it's like to worry about ourselves, to be concerned about ourselves. We can't turn that off. But the sameness of self and others says, okay, it's there. I care for myself. There's no difference. Others are the same. Yeah? So it's a basis for metta in a way. Yeah? We just realize our own self-centeredness. And the first step to go beyond it is to realize others have the same self-centeredness. That is, I'm important to myself, others are important to themselves. Yeah. Okay, that's a very sort of essentialized way of talking about metta, really. But that's not enough. So because we're so inborn selfish, Shantideva then comes with what he calls the biggest mystery. Other traditions call it the greatest exorcism. If you're into exorcism, that's how to do it. You exorcise the biggest demon, yeah? Or you practice the biggest mystery, which is the exchange of self and others. The practice means that, well, it's quite simply, you don't see everybody the same as you, you regard others as more important than you. Yeah? You really sort of, it's a bit, because we're so inborn selfish, you go to the other extreme. This is not a worldview, this is a method. Yeah? So you really regard others' happiness as more important than your own. Yeah? This is what Shantideva called the greatest mystery, what others call the greatest exorcism. Yeah? And as exorcisms can go wrong, maybe this can go wrong. So it's something to be done carefully. I think that's the point. Yeah? It's a kind of approach which was kept secret a long time and only passed from teacher to disciple personally. It's such a radical approach that it was never published in this book, funnily enough, but the practices connected to it weren't made public. Yeah. And I've seen people reading books about it and getting it completely wrong. Yeah. So there is a danger in this approach. It was an exorcism. I like that language somehow. And the biggest mystery. Yeah, so if you just go to the other extreme. So this is hardcore Buddhist practice. Yeah. So I'll give you a few quotes. This is Langri Tangpa, 8 verses. Whenever I'm in the company of others, may I regard myself as inferior to all, and from the depth of my heart cherish others as supreme. When someone out of envy does me wrong, and by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. Even if someone whom I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong by harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. Yeah? This is, I think these are the teachings which are sort of handled with care. Yeah? So these hard teachings. And you find the same attitude in the myth of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. Yeah, so in the story, you've got the two-armed and one-headed Avalokiteshvara taking the vow to work for the benefit of all beings. And his vow means, what he said was, as a vow, if I have only one selfish thought, and even if I only think of my own spiritual development, may my body explode. So in other words, if you take that literally, which I suggest we don't, but we need to take it seriously, if you take that seriously, you could argue any self-centered thought is already failure in the tradition. It's quite a thought, yeah? So this is basically this very extreme way of practicing. Don't worry, I'm going to make it easier later on if we address the balance a bit. Something I really like about that tradition is, if I could, this quote from, I think it's by Jamgon Kontor in the commentary. Concentrate only on what helps your mind and on doing the best you can to destroy ego clinging. Since freedom from ego clinging is Buddhahood, this single goal is enough. There is no need to enumerate the stages on the path. So in a sense, I quite like that approach because you don't even worry which stage on the path you're on. It's just a waste of time to even worry about it. The aim of this kind of tradition is you want to be so selfless that you don't even worry whether you've broken some fetters or reached this or that goal or whatever. Even thinking that is failure already. Yeah, I find it quite, there's something quite liberating about it. So yeah, this is sort of the exchanging self and others, the complete altruism of where metta leads to. Now, as you can gather, this is obviously very difficult. So something else has to come in order to be able to practice this. And I think this is where it can go wrong. I think it can go wrong in some ways that we do it with our egotism. I mean, I remember somebody on a retreat in Germany who read these texts and tried to practice them. And then she said something like, well, she was on some seminar or something and tried to practice seeing herself as the lowest. And then she complained that nobody noticed it. Oh, right, yeah, this is how it works. Yeah. So it can go wrong with these teachings, yeah. So in all these traditions, with the 7-point mind training and so on, before being able, or in the context of, or the context in which you practice these things, has to be insight into emptiness. Otherwise it doesn't work. Yeah? So this kind of altruism has to be on the basis of insight into shunyata, of emptiness. I mean, you've got it in the 7-point mind training, which is all these very altruistic and extreme slogan. Before you do them, you realize everything you experience is like a dream. So you practice complete selflessness in a dream world. So you don't take it too seriously. You don't take yourself too seriously in it. Yeah. We've got a similar theme in the Diamond Sutra. Yeah. The Bodhisattva vows to save all beings while knowing that beings don't exist. So it's a common theme in the Mahayana Sutras. This complete selflessness has to be on the basis of emptiness, of non-self. Yeah. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. It would probably lead to madness or something. So this is a warning. Bhante makes this point, it's a funny bit. This is from Bhante's lecture on the message of Dada Rinpoche. Rinpoche speaks of radiating love. But what does radiate mean? To radiate means, according to the dictionary, to emit from a center. But what is the center? I won't get too philosophical here, but the center is the middle point. I'm sorry, I have to ask another question, but what is a point? I'm afraid this is just one of my little habits, but what is a point? A point is defined as that which has position without magnitude. Yeah? So a point has no size, it's nothing. Yeah? It's a position without any magnitude. We can radiate love only from the middle point of our being. We can radiate love only from egolessness, from shunyata. We can radiate love only from that point within ourselves, which has position without magnitude. So we can radiate love only from shunyata, from emptiness. And so, you know, so basically what he's saying is, insight into shunyata and emptiness is necessary for this very radical kind of altruism of metta. So metta needs insight. And this leads me to the sort of last point of my talk, the last main topic. And this is sort of how the two parts of, or the other two parts of Dada's motto fit with radiate love, or how they fit together. Because when I talk about into the shunyata, I'm back at the first one, cherish the doctrine. Yeah. I was thinking about that. I think it fits very nicely with the way Padmasagara talked about the first motto by referring to this Mahayana Sutra, the Amitāya Dhyana Sutra. I think if we don't have a big enough vision of the universe, this kind of ideal is overwhelming. Or we live a fantasy Buddhist life. It's almost, I got a sense, the altruistic ideal is too big for a small universe. Yeah? The universe is such a, to save all beings and be completely selfless is such a big ideal, it's almost like we need to live in a universe which is big enough to contain it. Yeah? It has to be bigger than our materialistic universe. So we need a framework, a view on the universe which is big enough, which is of too big for this bodhisattva ideal to be a problem. So various ways in which the Maya does that. One I mentioned already, shunyata. Yeah? Only in a universe which is empty can you practice this kind of bodhisattva ideal. Yeah? Only in a universe, or if you live in a universe where beings don't exist, ultimately, can you save all beings? Otherwise, you go mad. Yeah? Or you end up depressed. So that's a sort of more the emptiness point of view. But I think you can see it positively, or there's a positive way of looking at that. If you take the sutra, the Amitāya Dhyana Sutra, which Padmasagara talked about, the universe, as the universe in which the sutra happens, is not only do we have the pure land of Amitāyas, so Kāvati, but at the beginning of the sutra, it was actually, I don't know how many, probably millions of Buddha fields. And you know, the queen chose one of them. She was shown this millions of Buddha fields full of Buddhas. Yeah, and she should have picked one of them. And then that got described. Yeah. So it's a universe which is full of Buddhas and Buddha fields. So I think this kind of practicing does only make sense within such a universe, which is too big, which is sort of bigger and very positive. I'm also reminded of the White Lotus Sutra. Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe to come back to the Pure Land Sutras. In a sense, what the Pure Land Sutras are saying is, Well, Amitabha's grace has already saved us, so don't worry. So you practice this kind of complete selflessness in a very positive worldview of other power, yeah, of the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Again, without the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, we can't do this. There's a split in the White Lotus Sutra. I was studying it last year after lockdown started. And it really struck me this time I studied it. I thought it was a brilliant text. It's wonderful. And there's a passage in the sutra where there's basically sort of thousands of bodhisattvas and Buddhas anyway around there. There's all these Buddhas and bodhisattvas. And they all take the vow to protect the Dharma, no matter what. And the Buddha says, don't worry, you don't need this. I don't need you to do this. And then even more bodhisattvas spring out from the earth. So millions of bodhisattvas, yeah. And they will do the job. They look after the Dharma. So what I mean is these sutras, they create a very positive, huge universe full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I think that's necessary as the background or the overall framework in which we may be able to practice this kind of altruism, this kind of selflessness. Because if you look at Mahayana, I mean, I found it interesting, so maybe a bit of a tangent of a side issue, but I said anyway. Well, if you think of it's almost, if you ever get confused about this, if you look at Mahayana texts, there's two different kinds of texts which give a different feeling. You've got Mahayana texts as these enormous sutras, White Lotus Sutra, Sutra of Golden Light, Vimalakirti Nidesha, the Pure Land Sutras, which has got this amazing universe full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and blessings going around all the time. Yeah? It's like this huge universe, this amazing world. And then you've got Mahayana and Bodhisattva ideal in a sort of mind-training Shantideva sense, which is this brutal, selfless practice. Yeah. And I think we need both. Mm. I think we actually need both. Yeah. And I think our problem often is with the Bodhisattva ideal and altruism is that we don't practice it in a big enough context, in a big enough universe. Yeah. So I think part of it is being open to the blessings of the Buddhas. I think we can't do it otherwise. Yeah. So I think in this way you can see that without cherishing the Dharma, we can't radiate love. It's not possible. Yeah. And also without the Dharma, our metta is not real metta. Yeah. It's only a sort of a Buddhist worldview which really makes sure metta is metta and not sentimentality or worldly well-wishing. Because ultimately, if you wish beings well, you wish them for them to go for refuge. You wish for them to practice the Dharma. Yeah. So it's understanding of the Dharma which clarifies our metta. And actually it enables us to practice metta. Yeah, so this is like how the first part of the slogan, the cherish the doctrine, feeds into radiate love and how they influence each other. But I think the same is also true for living united. So I think living united and radiating love, they also need to go together. Yeah. So I take living united now in the context of living united with other people. Yeah? So the aspect Vidyadhaka talked about other people and our teachers. I'm sure it can be worked out for the other aspect as well. I just haven't done it. So on the one hand, we need the Sangha to be truly altruistic. We are very limited in being of benefit for other people on our own. I mean, some of us more than others. Yeah. I sometimes think, the structures, I would even say, even the structures, the friendships, even the institutions of the movement make us more effective. Yeah. Some of us may not have, think of myself, I don't think I would be much good for humanity on my own. Probably, I don't think I would do much good, wouldn't be of much benefit for humanity left to myself. Yeah. I lack all the talents for it. But it was within the movement I can be of benefit. So I think if Triratna is great of giving useless people the ability to be of some good use. Don't underestimate that. We are also limited in communicating the Dharma on our own because we can't exemplify Sangha on our own. We can't. Yeah? So to be an individual Buddhist teacher, all we can do is, so, well, you can teach meditation, yeah, talk about the Dharma, but you can't show Sangha on your own, by definition. Yeah? So we are very limited, left to our own devices. So we need Sangha in order to radiate love. We need the Sangha to do that. It also makes it more attractive, because, as quoted Bhante at the beginning, we're not rational beings, we're emotional beings. And probably what many of us find attractive about Triratna is seeing people being friends, seeing people working together. Yeah, I find that, certainly for me, seeing people together, that's attractive. Yeah, so we need to live united in order to radiate love. It's necessary. But I think it also works the other way around. I think we need to radiate love in order to live united. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think without an altruistic dimension, a sangha can't function. I think it stagnates. Yeah. Also, sort of, sangha needs to be open to other people. I mean, Bhante said in one of his talks, the purpose of the spiritual community is two purposes. One is to exist, is all. The second purpose is to allow others to join it. Yeah. So the purpose of the spiritual community is to allow other people to join the spiritual community, to become part of it. Yeah, so for being united, we need to be altruistic. It's almost, I mean, I sometimes feel this Padmaloka, so at the moment, yeah, we do events and stuff, but which is good. I sometimes feel Padmaloka only becomes Padmaloka when we have a retreat on. When we have no retreat on, nurse we have at home, then we amongst ourselves, we have our friendships, it's all very good. But as soon as the retreats are set, now we become Padmaloka. Now we are what we should be. Yeah? So part of what we need is we need our work to function. Yeah? And I sometimes see it, I mean, it happens rarely, but I sometimes notice it, that some groups, it happens sometimes with going for refuge groups, they're so harmonious amongst each other, they love each other so much that they don't want to have new people joining them. And I think it always stagnates. I think it usually stagnates. It gets very sentimental, we love each other so much, we're such good friends. But if they're not open to new members, the stagnation is going to happen very soon. Yeah? I mean, you could say what I talked about, the individual problem is also a sort of collective problem. So, yeah, Buddhism says that too much self-concern, well, any self-concern, is the problem for the individual. Maybe it's the same for the spiritual community. Too much self-concern is the problem. Yeah. So just as sort of individual self-centeredness doesn't lead anywhere, collective self-centeredness also doesn't lead anywhere. Yeah. Something to discuss. It's also boring, collective self-concern, being concerned with yourself and your own group all the time. So I think living united and radiating love are very closely connected. So you can't have one without the other. You even find that in this Buddhist teaching, again, it's important in the Mahayana, which you find in the Pali Canon, you find the teaching that the means of unifying a Sangha and the means of converting people into Buddhism are the same thing. It's a Sangha-havastus. Yeah? I mean, just mention them, the generosity, loving speech, beneficial action, exemplification. I don't want to go into the details of them, it's enough material, but I think what I'm going to draw out now is the fact that it's the same, to unify a Sangha is the same practice as to expand it. The same thing. So the Sangha and Vassas are sometimes called the means of unification, unifying a Sangha. They are also called the means of conversion. And they're the same practices. So almost unifying a Sangha and expanding it seem to be the same thing. So thinking about this, there's a few more ideas, just to spark some discussion or reflection. As I thought about the three parts of Dao's motto, cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love, the more it seems to me they really hang together. I don't think you can have any of them without the other two. They don't make any sense alone. Yeah. I was talking to someone this afternoon about this, and we thought it would have been nice if the three would correspond to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but I'm afraid they don't. I mean, you've got the Dharma, yes, you've got the Sangha, but can you say radiate love is the Buddha? It needs a lot of tweaking, and so let's assume, well, they don't. It would have been really nice if they would correspond to the three jewels, but I'm afraid they don't, as far as I can see, unless you really interpret very creatively. So it's something different. But really, I think really looking deeper into them, for me, they almost merge into one. There are three ways of looking at the same thing. Yeah? Three ways of looking at the Buddhist life. So I think actually, if there's anything, so is there anything behind it? What would I call that which holds this together? And I said, it's actually the Bodhisattva idea. It's the Bodhisattva. Yeah? That's sort of what's behind those three and holds them all together and sort of unifies them. Yeah, so I think we can't look at them separate. Yeah? They need each other, and not only do they need each other, I think actually, if you go deeper into them, I suspect they're just different ways of talking about the same thing, which is the Buddhist life. Okay, thank you.